Chapter 41. Kidnappers. It was not until the second half of the 19th century that professional criminals thought of seizing a human hostage and holding him for ransom. In the days when crooks lived in slums and the rich resided in great houses or country estates, criminals seldom had a chance to encounter the children of the rich. Then came the age of industry and factories. Men acquired fortunes overnight, and many evildoers brooded on how to separate them from their wealth. It was in the United States, where the rich and the poor rubbed shoulders, that the first notable modern case of kidnapping occurred. It was conceived in the summer of 1874, when two men made a habit of driving past the home of Christian Ross, a once moderately successful Philadelphia grocer who had recently become bankrupt. The men stopped and spoke to Charlie Ross, aged 4, and to Walter Ross, aged 6, as the children played innocently on the sidewalk. On July the 1st, the children asked their new friends to buy them fireworks for the 4th of July celebrations. The men agreed and invited the youngsters to hop into the buggy. A few streets away, they gave Walter 25 cents and sent him to a nearby shop. When the little boy returned, the buggy had vanished, and his brother Charlie with it. The howling Walter was then taken home by a neighbour, and Christian Ross hurried to the police. Everyone was baffled. Why, they asked, should anyone steal a 4-year-old baby? The mystery was solved 2 days later, when the Rosses received a scrawled and badly spelled letter. It said, "You will have to pay us before you get him," but did not mention any sum. Such a thing had never been heard of in North America before. Indignation swept the country. Thousands of police joined in the search for little Charlie Ross. No one bothered about search warrants as they burst into any premises that might conceal the missing child. On July the 6th, Ross received a letter asking for $20,000 and threatening to kill the child if the hunt was not called off. He was told to insert an advertisement in the Philadelphia Ledger saying that he was ready to negotiate. Instead, he tried to drag out the correspondence, hoping that the kidnappers would provide a clue to their whereabouts. The men expressed their impatience at his tactics, and he countered by stating publicly that he was damned if he would compound a felony. His wife, however, was so shattered by the ordeal of waiting that he changed his mind and agreed to pay the $20,000 which he had managed to borrow. Ross went to an appointed rendezvous, but no one appeared to collect the money. And so month after month dragged by. There were more appointments, more correspondence, but still no sign of the missing child. The grim story ended 6 months later, on December the 14th, 1874, when a burglar alarm sounded in the home of a rich New Yorker, Holmes van der Brunt. It meant that burglars had broken into the summer residence belonging to his brother next door. Van Brunt and three other men duly crept up to the house with shotguns and waited. When, an hour later, the burglars came out, Van Brunt ordered them to halt. Instead, they started shooting. The Van Brunt party fired back with their shotguns, and both burglars fell. One of them gasped out a dying confession. His name was Joseph Douglas, and he and his companion, William Mosher, had kidnapped Charlie Ross. The boy would be returned alive and well within a few days, and then Douglas died. The confession was undoubtedly genuine, for the police already knew that Douglas and Mosher were the men they wanted. Another crook had informed on them. But no sign of flaxen-haired Charlie Ross was ever found. A third man, named William Westervelt, was tried as an accomplice and sentenced to 7 years' imprisonment, although there was no real evidence against him, a sign of how much frustrated anger had been aroused by the kidnapping. The age of kidnapping had arrived. But fortunately for parents and relatives, it got off to a slow start. This was partly due to the death of poor Charlie Ross, for in February 1875, the legislature of Pennsylvania passed a law defining kidnapping, setting the penalty at a maximum of 25 years solitary confinement and a fine of $100,000. It's a measure of how much horror was excited by the Ross affair. There is also a certain irony to it. The word kidnapping was originally coined in England about 200 years earlier, and the kids who were nabbed were usually sent to America as cheap labour on the tobacco plantations. Now America was forced to enact the first law against the crime. At about the time of the Charlie Ross kidnapping, a country on the other side of the globe was being forced to give serious thought to the question of how to stamp it out. In Greece, as in Corsica and Sicily, kidnapping was a long-established custom, and brigandage was looked upon as an almost respectable occupation. In 1870, however, the whole system backfired and nearly caused the occupation of Greece by England. On April the 11th, Lord Muncaster, an Irish peer, together with his wife and a distinguished party of tourists, set out to see the ancient battlefield of Marathon, the site of the Athenians' victory over the Persians in around 490 BC. A group of soldiers warned them about brigands and started to escort them back to Athens. But the soldiers were too slow, and the carriages rushed on ahead. A band of brigands led by the notorious Arvanitakis brothers swooped down and seized them, then forced them to run at top speed over rough countryside. Negotiations with the authorities followed, and the females, including a six-year-old girl, were released, together with Lord Muncaster. Four men, including an Italian nobleman, Count Alberto de Boy, remained hostages. The ransom demanded was £50,000. Alternatively, the brigands sought a complete amnesty. Previous hauls had made them rich. They wanted to be able to return to society. When he heard of the outrage, King George of Greece was so upset that he offered to hand himself over to the brigands as a hostage. For the next 10 days, however, negotiations dragged inconclusively on. The Greek government categorically refused to grant an amnesty, but Takos Avanitakis, the brigand chief, said that there had to be one, otherwise the prisoners would be killed. Troops drew up near the ravine where he held the four prisoners, while negotiators tried to pursue the brigands to take the ransom and withdraw over the Turkish border. Then something went wrong. The troops, unable to resist taking a potshot, opened fire. The brigands fled towards the village of Thilesi, and on the way the four captives were callously murdered. Seven brigands, including one of the leaders, were killed. Six more were captured. Takos and seven others escaped to Turkey. The furore that followed was tremendous. England burst into roars of rage. The British said that if Greece couldn't cope with her own brigands, England should invade the country and do it for them. The Russians promptly stated that in the event of hostilities, they would go to war to help Greece. Investigating commissions were set up. Dozens of men who'd helped the brigands were rounded up. 50 eventually went on trial, though most were released. The Thilesi murders, as they were known, became the scandal of Europe, and Greece lost face badly in the eyes of the world. The government was brought down. One of the brigands was extradited from Turkey and beheaded. Takos himself was finally shot 2 years after the killings. And in Greece, at least, kidnapping ceased to be a more or less acceptable custom. In the United States, on the other hand, its popularity was growing. In June 1907, in the Italian district of New Orleans, 7-year-old Walter Lamana went off trustingly with a man who offered him his hand. His father soon received a demand for $6,000, and it eventually became clear that the kidnappers were the Mafia, or Black Hand. The organisation already ran the Italian part of New Orleans, as Al Capone was to run Chicago 20 years later. The publicity aroused by the kidnapping led many Italians to admit that they had been paying protection money for years. One of the gang was arrested, Frank Gendusa. Under questioning, he admitted to being involved in the kidnapping, but said that he didn't know where the child was. Other members of the gang were then taken into custody. One of them, Ignacio Campestiano, was captured by a posse, who used a time-honoured method to induce him to talk. They bound his hands, put a noose around his neck, and pulled it tight over the branch of a tree. Campestiano broke down and led them to a dirty swamp where, wrapped in a blanket, was the body of the missing boy. The child had kept crying for his mother, he said, and one of the men had strangled it. In fact, Walter had been killed with a hatchet blow. Four of the kidnappers went on trial, including Tony Costa, who had actually abducted the youngster. They were found guilty without capital punishment, and for a while it looked as if the angry crowds of New Orleans would take justice into their own hands and lynch them, as they had done in 1890, when 9 members of the Mafia were acquitted of the murder of the chief of police and were subsequently dragged from their cells and killed by the mob. But the crowd was persuaded to disperse quietly. The trial of 2 other accomplices, Nicolina and Leonardo Gebbia, had to be postponed for another 4 months because public feeling ran so high. The Gebbias were both found guilty. Leonardo was hanged and his sister sentenced to life imprisonment. The man who actually killed Walter Lamana was never caught, but at least his crime had one beneficial result. The power of the Black Hand in New Orleans was crushed and broken. It was slowly becoming clear to the police and to the general public that the surest way of dealing with kidnappers, and of lessening the danger to their hostages, was to pay the ransom, and then to let the police take up the trail. The value of this method was proved in 1909 in Sharon, Pennsylvania. On March the 18th, a man drove up to the local school and explained that he'd been sent to collect Billy Whittler, the 8-year-old son of a wealthy attorney. His father needed him immediately at the office. The boy was allowed to go, and that afternoon Mr. Whittler received a ransom note demanding $10,000. No doubt recalling the Ross case, Whittler declined to cooperate with the police. He delivered the ransom according to the instructions, and his son was safely returned. Skillful police work, aided by luck, located the room where the boy had been held by a man and a woman. Detailed descriptions of them led to the arrest of James H. Boyle and his wife within 6 days of the kidnapping. Both were sentenced to life imprisonment. But it was in the 1920s, the bootleg era, that kidnapping became a major criminal undertaking in the United States. Possibly the Sicilian gangsters recalled how lucrative such activities had been in their homeland. For these gang snatches, children were no longer the automatically chosen victims. The gangsters realised it was just as easy to kidnap a rich businessman, and it aroused less public indignation. Even when it became a crime punishable by death, the crooks didn't seem to be deterred. One of the classic police investigations into such a snatch occurred in 1933. The millionaire Charles F. Urschel was sitting on the porch of his home in Oklahoma City, playing cards with his wife and another couple. Suddenly, two men with Tommy guns appeared. When Urschel and his friend refused to say which was Urschel, they were both bundled into a car and driven away. A few hours later, the friend reappeared. He had been released by the kidnappers when they established his identity. Edgar Hoover, director of the FBI, personally took charge of the investigation. Urschel, so he told the agents, was driven for 12 hours and then taken to a house where he was blindfolded. He was made to write a ransom note, and then for the next 8 days he was kept tied up in a dark room. But he kept his wits about him, and he noted that aeroplanes flew overhead at 9:45 every morning and at 5:45 every afternoon, all except for Sunday, when a heavy storm apparently prevented the 5:45 from passing that way. The following day he was driven a further distance and then put down at a railroad station and released. His ransom of $200,000 had been paid. The aeroplanes were the only clue the authorities had to go on. Hoover's men studied hundreds of airline schedules. Since the drive had taken about 12 hours, they assumed that the hideaway must be within about 300 miles of Oklahoma City. Next, after hours of painstaking research, they located an air route that crossed a certain point in Texas at 9:45 each morning and at 5:45 each afternoon. They were even able to verify that on the Sunday, a heavy storm had caused the plane to turn off its usual route. The town in question was called Paradise. And in Paradise, they discovered, lived the mother of Catherine Kelly, wife of a gangster named Machine Gun George Kelly, who was prominent on the list of suspects for the kidnapping. Posing as state surveyors, FBI men then called at the house. One of them asked for a drink of water. It tasted bitter with minerals, just as Urschel had described it. A few days later, the FBI swooped at dawn and found Harvey Bailey, identified as the second kidnapper, with a Tommy gun at his side. Another accomplice, Albert Bates, was traced when he got into a fight in Denver, Colorado. The money the police found on him was from the kidnap ransom, the bill numbers of which had all been noted. For a few months, Machine Gun Kelly became the latest public enemy number one. He even wrote letters threatening to kill Urschel. And then, in October, a girl in Memphis, Tennessee, confided to a school friend that her parents were not actually her parents. They had borrowed her. A policeman who heard this story from his child made a cautious investigation. There was another dawn raid, and as the armed police burst into his bedroom, Machine Gun Kelly threw up his hands and yelled, "Don't shoot, G-men!" It was the first time Hoover's men had been called G-men, meaning government men, and the name stuck. As for Kelly, he died 21 years later in Leavenworth Penitentiary. Before the snatching of aviator Charles A. Lindbergh's son in 1932, America's most famous and horrible kidnapping case was that of the Fox. It was the signature on the ransom note sent to Perry Parker, father of 12-year-old Marion Parker. Parker was a Los Angeles banker, and Marion had been abducted from her school one day in December of 1928. During the next few days, Parker received more letters signed The Fox, or Fate, and it was clear that the sender had a sadistic desire to make the parents suffer. Finally, Parker kept his rendezvous with the kidnapper. He could see Marion sitting stiffly beside him in the car. He handed over the money, and the man drove off, promising to let Marion out at the end of the street. When Parker reached her, she was dead. Her legs had been hacked off, and her eyes propped open with wire. Her legs were found in a nearby park, but the shirt in which they were wrapped gave the police the vital clue. It led them to 20-year-old Edward Hickman, who said that he wanted $1,500 in ransom money to go to college. He also had a grudge against Parker, whom he considered responsible for a prison sentence he'd received for forgery. Hickman proved to be an almost manic egoist, revelling in the publicity. He was hanged in San Quentin jail in 1928. After carpenter Bruno Hauptmann's execution for the murder of the Lindbergh baby in 1935, the kidnapping boom came to an end. As a result of the case, laws known as the Little Lindbergh Laws came into operation in various states. These made it a capital offence to commit kidnapping, even if it didn't involve a removal across state lines, if any physical harm came to the victim. In New York State, sometime later, a man was convicted of kidnapping for forcing a young girl, whom he subsequently molested, to accompany him from the street and onto the roof of a nearby building. Even the sending of a ransom note could mean a maximum penalty in a federal court of 20 years imprisonment or a fine of $5,000, or both. In 1960, Australia had its first child kidnapping case. 8-year-old Graham Thorne was the son of a travelling salesman from Sydney. His parents had recently won $100,000 in a lottery. Graham's corpse was found near a beach a month after his disappearance, and scientific examination of the rug in which the body was wrapped finally led the police to the house where he'd been taken, and eventually to Leslie Stephen Bradley, a married man with three children who was arrested on board a ship bound for England. England's first kidnapping case occurred in December 1969, when Mrs. Muriel Mackay, wife of a senior Fleet Street newspaper executive, disappeared from her home in Wimbledon in South London. 9 years earlier in France, however, another snatch had taken place which gained almost as much worldwide headlines as the Mackay story. Little Eric Peugeot, aged four, the son of the Paris automobile millionaire Raymond Peugeot, was taken from the playground of a fashionable golf club on the outskirts of the city. His captors, Raymond Roland and Pierre Lacher, were two small-time crooks who wanted money in order to indulge their taste for nightclubs and blondes. They demanded $35,000 from the Peugeot family, a mere trifle to Monsieur Peugeot, who handed over the ransom himself. Fortunately for him and his wife, the kidnappers kept their word, and Eric was returned a short while later, unharmed. It was not until October 1962, however, that Roland and Lacher, who had been captured living it up in a ski resort chalet with a Danish beauty queen and a striptease dancer, were put on trial. They were each sentenced to the maximum sentence under French law of 20 years imprisonment, and the Peugeots, who had recovered some $10,000 of the ransom money, were awarded the symbolic sum of 1 franc in damages.